This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. There's this river in Georgia that snakes for more than 100 miles from the coast to the heart of the state. It's called the Altima River, and it's Georgia's little Amazon as well. It has bald eagles, wild hogs, and legend has it, its own river monster. A new novel by writer Taylor Brown weaves two stories that take place 500 years apart on that wild and mysterious river. One storyline follows two brothers as they travel down the waters carrying their father's ashes to the sea. The other tracks the journey of Jacques Lemoyne. He's alleged to be the first European artist in America and was part of a 16th century French expedition at the Altamaha River. The book is called The River of Kings, and joining me now is Taylor Brown, who joins us from partner station WHQR in Wilmington. Thanks for being with us, Taylor.
Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, tell us more about this river, the Altamaha River in Georgia, 137 miles long. It's a big, big river, right?
Oh, yeah. I think it's the third largest contributor of freshwater to the Atlantic Ocean. Most people don't really know that much that exists, but, you know, it's undammed. It's crossed by roads only five times. As you were saying, you know, it's home to all kinds of rare and endangered species and even rumored to have its own river monster.
You ran into some of those legendary figures on a trip that you took when you were in college. Of course, any college trip you take is suspect in terms of remembering the details. But tell us about this, because you stumbled on some pretty mysterious stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this novel really started, the seed of this novel was a direct experience I had on the river. It was during college, during spring break. A couple of my good buddies and I went on a two-night paddle trip, and it was the second day, and we stopped on this little bluff just to eat lunch. And to give you an idea, I mean, this is a very uninhabited section of the river. The whole river is pretty wild. I mean, the Nature Conservancy is called the Altamaha, one of the last 75 great places on Earth. So what we didn't expect to find was this man-made trail off into the woods. So we start following this trail, and the first thing we come across is this 4-foot alligator gar just lying across the path. And if listeners have never seen an alligator gar, I mean, it is the closest thing to a living dinosaur.
What is that? I don't even know what that is. Alligator gar?
Alligator gar. It's a fish with this that has this bony armor and this long toothed snout like a crocodile. They call it a living fossil. I mean, that's one thing that scientists call it. And this one had been cut open and left on the path just like a warning.
Okay, step one.
So, yeah,
but you're not done yet,
going.
Right?
Yeah. No, we keep going. And next, and I have pictures of this, actually, we come to two saplings that are tied together across the trail to make a little arch, dangling from which are small skulls hanging on links of fishing line. Ooh. So at this point, we really probably should have turned around and run, but we keep going.
Are you hearing the banjos yet?
I know.
All right, go ahead.
So next, we come to the shed back out in the woods. And tin roof, you know, no door, just a burlap flap for a door. Oh. And we really should have turned around and run, but I think we were, you know, 20, 21 at the time, probably more hormones than brains. And so we decided that we were going to have to see what was in this place. So we jump inside. And thank God it was empty in there. It looked like it had been quickly vacated. Dirt floor, drag marks on the floor. And so the mystery of what that place was and who built it and why it was there really kicked off this whole novel for me.
And a river, again, wild enough, not only the mystery of that particular mystery, but again, 137 miles of river undammed. This is a wild place, wild enough to allow somebody like that to be living unmolested, you would think. For all those years. So, and there's folklore. I mean, there's even a river monster that's alleged to be in this river, right?
Yes, the Altamaha, they call it. And the early explorers reported the Native Americans telling them about a water serpent. And since then, there have been sightings all the way up through the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, all the way up until today. And there's even a reproduction, a model of the Altamaha, otherwise known as Alti, kind of like Lessie in the Loch Ness, in the visitor center in Darien, Georgia, which is the town closest to the river's mouth. And interestingly enough, Darien was founded by Scottish Highlanders from the banks of Loch Ness. So whether that contributed to the creation of this myth, this idea of the monster, we don't really know.
If it's meant to spawn tourism, you got a marketing problem because nobody's afraid of the Altamaha.
Right.
I'm just saying, it just doesn't sound scary to me. But it's a very cool lesson, and it's been part of this river. So tell us when, now you're talking about college, you have this experience, it stayed with you. When did you decide to write this book? And give us a little more background now on the plot, two plot lines, really, in your new book, The River of Kings.
So really, it was 10 years later, I think, about a decade later, that I decided to get back on the river with a couple of my buddies from that first trip and see if we could find that shed. And we were not able to find it, but going back out on the river again kind of gave me the material and the inspiration I needed to get started on this book. And it actually started as a short story. And I say sometimes that, you know, if you work really hard and you keep your antenna up, sometimes magic things happen. And that really happened with this book because I write this short story, and the climax of the short story is in this big bend in the river at an area they call June Hole. And after writing that story, at some point I realized that that bend in the river is also where many scholars now think that Fort Caroline was located, which was the first fortified European settlement in the New World. So I didn't set out necessarily to weave together these timelines that were almost 500 years apart. It seemed almost like I was discovering, just unearthing them as I went along, and the book just seemed to me, to some degree, to want to be written in that way, to pull these storylines together. So you have two brothers who are, with a contemporary storyline, who are going down the river. They're delivering their father's ashes. And he died under mysterious circumstances on the river. He was a shrimper. The Department of Natural Resources say he was killed by a sturgeon strike. So in the summer, these sturgeon, these huge armored fish, kind of like alligator gar, jump out of the river, and people get really hurt and killed. And then that's weaved together with the story of the French at Fort Caroline who are coming upriver. So kind of the French are coming upriver as the brothers in the contemporary storyline are coming downriver.
And it includes Jacques Lemoyne, a historical figure reputed to be the first artist who's sort of documenting in sketches the journey of the French in this part of the world, right? Tell us more about Jacques Lemoyne.
Indeed. He's a fascinating character. I mean, when I discovered him, I felt as if I had unearthed the treasure trove that I've been sitting on top of my whole life. So not only is he reputed to be the first, European artist in the New World, we have his illustrations. Now, the provenance of them is slightly dubious. We don't know if some of them survived or if he redid them, and there are some questions around that. But needless to say, we actually have his illustrations, which are some of the first depictions of Native Americans and the flora and the fauna of the New World. And they're actually in the book. Every French chapter in the book it ends with one of his illustrations. And I was able to really use those as a keystone for me with the book and the plot, because most of the chapters are based off of one of the scenes that he depicts, from Native American rituals to Native Americans hunting alligators to just the flora and fauna that he sees. And what's so fascinating to me about Lemoyne is that, he was this courtly flower painter before he goes on this expedition, across the ocean to this new world, and somehow survives. And by the time this is all over, he's very much a hardened veteran, that has survived famine and war and battle and all kinds of things. And so makes for a fascinating character to me.
Maybe I could ask you to read from a section in which Jacques Lemoyne features prominently.
Absolutely. So this is from the first chapter that has Lemoyne in it. And you're going to see that he sees something that looks suspiciously like our Altamahaha. They have come north, looking for a river deep enough to accommodate their fleet. Today it seems they have found it, sailing upstream into this unknown land. Lemoyne squints through the failing light. The sun is down, the river like polished black marble. It is the hour between the dog and the wolf, when the world grows smoky with night falling, when you cannot tell whether the beast from the woods is friend to you or enemy. A cry goes up from the bow, now others, and men race toward the foredeck. Lemoyne dashes among them, elbowing his way to the rail. He looks past the bowsprit, seeing the reason for their cries. The stick of charcoal slips from his hand, crushed underfoot as he staggers back from the rail. Soupente de mer, cry the men. Monster! It is thrice humped from the water, this monster, its spine armored like the giant lizards that sun themselves on the river banks. But it makes newt of such creatures.
a serpent the size of a cypress tree mounding its way through the water, a string of stony dark islands. For long seconds, the creature swims upriver before their bow, as if leading them, only to slide beneath the surface, swallowed in black glass. Lemoyne can hardly breathe, his heart sounding wildly against his ribs. He has been tasked on this journey to fill the white spaces on the map, the places that warn of dragons. And now it seems he must fill those oceans of white with blacker terror still.
Wilmington-based writer Taylor Brown reading from his new novel, The River of Kings. It's fascinating because you give us in this one narrative that threads throughout the book this kind of sense of the exotic that Europeans would have felt coming to the North American continent and this kind of disconnect between the natural environment that they're seeing and trying to fit it into place. The contemporary story is also a kind of picture of alienation and a sense of being estranged from the land to some degree. Tell us about the two brothers and their journey on the river.
Yeah, I think that, so the two brothers are Hunter and Lawton, and there's really some friction between those two because they grew up with an abusive father, certainly verbally abusive, to some degree physically abusive, and they have very much gone on divergent paths. Hunter, the younger, is in college. He's a history major, and Lawton is a Navy SEAL who's home on leave to take this trip with his brother and deliver their father's ashes down the river. And so there's some friction between them having taken these different paths. You know, Hunter is probably the first in their family to go to college, which, creates probably, that's a bold move in and of itself to some degree, I think, and away from the path that was probably set before them to some degree. And as they go down the river, Lawton is also very convinced that the story of their father's death is not the one they're being told by the Department of Natural Resources, by the Sheriff's Department. He seems incapable of accepting the fact that their father died, you know, from a sturgeon strike. And there are a number of, you know, mysterious things around his death that point toward there being some kind of funny business going on. While Hunter at the other time is, on the other hand, is more accepting of it, but less accepting of their father himself. And I think they're really struggling over who their father was and how they're going to remember him and what his legacy is going to be, you know, and how having a father that was abusive like that shaped them to become the men they are.
Can I ask you to read another passage for us and maybe set
Absolutely.
It up for us?
Absolutely. So this is a scene where Hunter, the younger brother, is at the boat ramp when the sheriffs bring their father in, when they find his body on the river. And he unzips the bag and sees their father. Hunter was at the ramp when the sheriffs brought him in. They let him unzip the bag. The old man was shirtless, his skin white as something from a horror film. Hunter hadn't realized how much age and time had damaged the old man's tattoos, muddled them. They covered him like old bruises. There was the river assault tattoo from his time in the Brownwater Navy, a devil's head with downturned trident, mark of the Delta Devils, terrors of the Mekong. The insignia lay bleary now upon his shoulder, made as if by a bully's fist. On his left chest, the inscription Sat Kong, death to communists, tattooed as tribute to the Biet Hai Sea Commandos who wore it there, a death sentence if they were captured. There were the swooping swallows, one on each shoulder, to carry him to heaven if he died at sea, and the North Star to help him find his way home, its points dull now over his heart. All these signs and wonders inked upon his skin, symbols of power and luck, and a new one among them they couldn't stop. Square in his chest was a depression, a sunken wound the size of a man's fist, the color of storm. Burst veins fractured it, jagged and red. Hunter touched two fingers to the place, his father's heart softer now than it had ever been, broken.
Wilmington-based writer Taylor Brown reading from his new novel, The River of Kings. You weave these themes together in these two narratives, 500 years apart, themes of identity, story, separating fact from fiction and the way in which fiction can become fact in the telling of a story. All of these wonderful kind of deep themes. What was it like for you trying to stay on these two separate narratives and make them work together as a book?
Gosh, and now I look back and I'm not sure sometimes exactly how I did it, but I think that I have the river to thank, to be honest, because the geography of the river itself is what really helped me keep the storylines together. And the way I mean that is there are points on the river that were there in the 16th century and are still there, that both, that people would have seen no matter when they lived. And those really helped to anchor the book and anchor the two stories together, you know, and all of these great places that had to be in the book, Alligator Congress and Stud Horse Creek and Rifle Cut and all kinds of places like that. So as a river itself really helped me tie things together and hopefully, you know, using the geography to echo one storyline against the other and things like that. And then lots and lots of book research, reading the original narratives and translations from the French colonists, and lots of research on the river itself. I was lucky enough to have buddies that would go out with me on the river, and we did some pretty serious exploring.
Sounds great. Well, your previous novel, Fallen Land, was set in the Civil War, so apparently this kind of historical fiction or taking this approach is something that appeals to you.
It does, absolutely. You know, I wouldn't say that I start out to write historical fiction at all. I start out to write what I think of, I guess, as literary fiction, but I find these historical settings and stories that just really grab me. And I think there's a few different reasons for that. One is just there's the almost archaeological aspect of it that's just sometimes I feel like I'm this historical detective trying to dig out these, you know, nuggets of history. And two, I think it's a really interesting way for us to, you know, think about what's happening in the world now and seeing it through a historical lens. You know, they say, you know, tell it, but tell it slant. And I kind of think about using history to be able to do that.
Great.
And certainly this book with the, you know, the kind of circularity of history and stuff works with that very well.
This book is The River of Kings. The author is Taylor Brown, my guest today on The State of Things. Taylor, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Taylor Brown, author of The River of Kings, speaking to us from member station WHQR in Wilmington. And you can find out more about his book at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.